we never rocking let, this morning.
We never let the music go this long.
Nah,
it's kind of fun.
We go.
Actually, I kind of like it. We should do that more. So, welcome to We the People.
Yeah,
and sorry,
us.
Been on a little hiatus.
Yeah, we lost our minds for what, 3 weeks?
We did too. Yeah. We just had stuff.
Yeah,
trade shows and stuff going on.
Traveling here and there.
So we played you some of the best of for the last few weeks. And actually, I have to say, I think they like us better on recorded than they do in real life.
Yeah, the numbers proved it. Yeah, we need to just go away. We're a hindrance.
We need to just go away. Let's just do the shows we already did.
We're messing
just
up our own show.
Leave it alone.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're glad you guys liked it. There was a lot of good information in there. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power, John Deere and Kubota here in Shasta Lake, California. You need a tractor, any kind of a tractor, we'll get it for you. But we're a John Deere Kubota dealer, and right now they're running service specials. If you've got a machine that needs to get tuned up or ready for the spring, bring it in. We'll get right on it and get it out of there. You can reach them at 226-9226. And they're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, just south of Phil's Propeller. They're on Twin View Boulevard. Team Power.
Just north of Reading.
There you go.
All righty.
Who do we have today?
Well, okay, first, I was going to say, I know a lot of our people are finding us, obviously, online. The website is wethepeopleradio.us. We put a page together for every show, and then after the show, we put you with an archive on there so you can listen, actually commercial free. So we celebrate capitalism during the show, and then we sort of eliminate the capitalism after that, which does save you a little time. And you can forward to your friends. There's an MP3 file on there, and it goes back to like 2010. Got years of information. So we have two people on today. The first half of the show is Rahil Raza. We've had her on before. She's a Clarion Project Advisory Board member. And then the second half, we're going to talk about the FISA court with our national security guest, Bruce Moran.
Everybody's talking about FISA nowadays.
So I guess we'll all get smart about the FISA court and how that all works and some of the stuff with McCabe and all that jazz.
Yeah.
But Rahil is going to come on with us today and talk about I'll just read her little thing here. Rahil Raza contends that America's youth are being radicalized and that this crisis requires immediate action to prevent violent attacks in the United States and the Western world. And I think after we all watched the youth of America march yesterday to have their constitutional rights taken away.
Yeah, they're a little confused on that.
Like
it was
going
it
backwards.
Was a march about school safety, but it
somehow
turned
became
out to be
anti-gun
rally. So, yeah, a little mixed.
So I was
message
kind of excited
there.
Today. We were talking about helping the youth not be radicalized to do bad things.
Yeah, like take our rights away.
Yeah, that too. Rahil, how's it going in there?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Last time we chatted with you, you're on your way to the airport. So hopefully we caught you on a less dramatic Sunday. How's that?
Yes, it's always dramatic, but world events sort of keep me on my toes. But I'm not going to the airport right now. I'm traveling tomorrow.
You have like family in the car and you're trying to negotiate the terms.
I know. I apologize.
No, it was kind of fun riding along with you. No, we enjoyed it. So you are a Clarion Project Advisory Board member, and you're a founding member of the Muslim Reformer Movement, and you're also an international human rights activist. And you live in Canada, right?
I live in Canada. I'm in Toronto.
Right. So you want to put a little plug in about the Clarion Project before we get started?
Yes, of course. The Clarion Project actually specializes in exposing the dangers of radical Islamist ideology, and at the same time gives voice to progressive liberal humanist Muslims like myself, and they do this through campaigns, they do this through documentaries. They make excellent documentaries, and they have a daily newsletter which goes out to thousands of people, and it keeps them abreast of what is happening in the world. And as you know, there's always something happening, which is not always good. So, their daily events, and Clarion has their finger on the pulse. They do a lot of investigation. They do a lot of work in counterterrorism, but they're also very concerned about presenting programs that are about prevention. And this current campaign that I'm involved in and that we're dealing with is an educational program to prevent the spread of radical Islamist ideology and violence among children and youth.
Outstanding. Does that make you pretty popular in your community, or does that work?
Of course, they love me to talk about things that they want to push under the carpet. But, you know, this is the point. The point is that this is an issue that has not been on the front burner, and, you know, there isn't a national program to talk about nonviolent extremism. I was, you know, I gave testimony to Congress, to the U.S. Congress in July, and I made four recommendations, and one of them was to counter this ideology, because this is a war of ideas, and the nonviolent ideology is what radicalizes youth, and there are statistics to prove it, because, you know, George Washington has a program on extremism, and they tell us that 153 individuals were charged in the U.S. with offenses related to the Islamic State, and 22% of them were 20 or younger.
Wow.
So the extremists specialize in mobilizing youth, in targeting youth, and, of course, in parts of the world where they're active, you know, where ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are active, they actively recruit young people, train them in madrasas, brainwash them. And they find that using even young children as young as 6 or 7 years old is very effective for them, because, you know, children can infiltrate into places where adults sometimes can't. But it's so evil, the fact that they are targeting our youth right here in America.
Yeah, and it's easy for them to radicalize them. It's very difficult for, you know, in our society, children are innocent. You don't do anything to harm a child, but yet they can militarize a child and send them out into our society.
Well, people aren't paying attention to what their kids are doing, especially online.
That's a tough
one. Your note here was kind of astounding. It says, according to CIA estimates, about 2,000 Westerners have traveled to Iraq and Syria, many via Turkey, to join ISIS.
Yes, they have, and many of them have been from the United States. And we are talking not just about Muslim youth. We are talking about Muslim and non-Muslim youth. So these extremists will target those youth who are vulnerable, those who have a vacuum in their lives. You know, young people are angry. They're, you know, angry about something all the time. They are angry at the status quo. They're isolated. And, you know, we see what is happening to the family structure. So not all parents are involved in what their children are doing. And this is how drug gangs work, you know, when they suck children into drugs and violence. But these are issues that are discussed in schools. You know, in schools, they'll talk about drug gangs. They'll tell the children to be aware of bullying. Now, they don't ever talk about radicalization. And what the Clarion Project has done is they have a campaign this year. They're producing a documentary in the fall called Jihad Generation, in which they have researched for 2 years the stories of those mothers and families whose children have been radicalized, who have said that if we could have seen the warning signs, perhaps we could have done something. So taking that into mind, the Clarion Project is creating educational programs that they want to work with law enforcement, with security agencies, with educators, with teachers, so that they can hopefully create that awareness and the prevention before the radicalization takes place.
Yeah, because there's been, you know, we've kind of swung hard the other way. You're not allowed, you know, we've almost made it a topic you're not allowed to discuss. I think it's probably high time. We need to take a really quick break and we'll come right back with you.
Okay.
There's quite a bit of information on this. And if you would like to find out more about Rahil Raza's work, you can find it all on WeThePeopleRadio.us.
That's me.
We are back. Rahil, we were talking about your program with the Clarion, and I was curious, where are you taking this? I mean, where are you teaching this in grade schools, in high schools?
Well, that is the hope. So at the moment, I have been traveling to various states and speaking to communities, speaking to educators, to law enforcement, to see where we can successfully use these programs. And mm-hmm. we are willing to cater the programs according to the needs of the community. So a month ago, I was in Minneapolis, and you may know that there is a very large Somali community, immigrant community that settled in Minneapolis. And there I met activists from the community, including a group called Mothers Against Youth Radicalization. Now, these are Somali Americans who are very concerned about the fact that their youth have been sucked in or manipulated to go and fight with Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization.
Sure.
And sometimes it happens under their noses and they don't know. So these mothers were weeping and they were saying that our youth are being radicalized. We know that. We don't know where and how it's happening and we need help. So what I'm doing at the moment as a preempt to the actual documentary and the work is meeting communities, meeting State Department people, law enforcement, security agencies, Homeland Security to see how we can expose the issue. The biggest drawback, of course, is the political correctness. And as you know, people are afraid to address the issue. So we want to encourage them to talk about it. And then once they agree to partner with us, we will engage community stakeholders to introduce this this program along with health education and social studies. We'll host workshops for stakeholders on how to identify individuals who may be at risk and how to provide a healthy outlet for these young people who are being appeased and wooed by the extremists.
Sure.
Because
they're at that age. They're at that age where they're looking for a cause or looking for to be a part of something. And unfortunately, this is what's happening.
And the parents don't see it coming?
Not all the time, you see, because which parent thinks that my child is going to get radicalized or my child is going to be converted to a radical form of this Islamist ideology? But this is what we want to do by speaking to the parents and giving, you know, asking them to look for the signs. Look for the signs of isolation. Look for the signs of an intense abnormal curiosity about the terrorists and the extremists. This is what we have studied from those who have already been radicalized, that, you know, the extremists work on the internet, they troll the internet,
sure,
these young people, and then they give them an idea that somehow they're going to be embraced by a brotherhood, and, you know, this is
right.
going to be, which, of course, is a cult. And these young people have no idea what they are heading into. It's only when they get there that they realize that they're going to be taught how to be suicide bombers or even that their lives are at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when they come back, they've already been radicalized and then they are a danger to the society that they're living in. And what the extremists delight in doing is training them and sending them back so that they can harm the very country in which they live, the people among whom they live.
We've
seen this time and again.
Is there any... I guess I'm kind of curious because I know some of these kids have come here after living in those countries. Do they actually join after they see what these people have done? You know, if they live in a country that's constantly being blown up and then they come here, do they actually want to go back and be part of that? Or is it just kids who are kind of, you know, stupid and naive, you know, and think it's a, you know, cause?
Well, you know, there is something known as brainwashing. And when kids are convinced that they're going to do something that is going to change the world, the way it is presented to them is in a very romanticized way.
Mm-hmm.
So the messages that are coming from some Islamist organizations, they're not telling the kids outright, pick up a gun and go kill your friend. What they do is work on them. They tell them that, you know, this country is your enemy. Their values and your values are not in sync. And we're going to help you find a way in which to, you know, better yourself, and you're going to do something that will change the world. And this is how they convince them. Why else would somebody, a young normal person, strap a bomb and go kill themselves?
Sure.
Obviously, they work on them, and, you know, young people are full of testosterone. And this is not something that happens overnight. It's done over a period of time. And our hope is that we can intervene before these kids are totally radicalized. Because, look, some of them have, you know, genuine grievances. You know, no country is perfect. They have grievances, but they need to be told that there is a way of addressing those grievances in a democratic way. You know, they need to find political solutions. They need to find counseling. But if the teachers and the parents and the clerics are not even aware of the problem, how are they going to find the solution? So we want to help them how to identify social clues, using techniques which we have derived from neuro-linguistic programming. And actually, we've had a successful, by we, I mean Clarion has had, is produced a successful CVE program used by an African NGO that is struggling with the threat of terrorism. And, you know, the mothers and the fathers, they're concerned. The parents are concerned about what is happening and the fact that the messaging that is coming from some of these institutions is not a message of compassion and love and tolerance.
No.
It's a message of us and them. It's a message of division. And how do you teach a young person to harm another one? You create hate. And we want to track where this messaging of hate, where this incitement towards hate is coming from.
Now, is part of your program showing these kids an alternative and some kind of a program that includes them in the community and gets them involved in something other than this?
Absolutely. To encourage and empower them to get involved is extremely important. So, you know, I've been meeting with organizations that work with drug gangs, for example. There's an organization, I was in L.A. last week, and they have an organization there called Peace Over Violence, a brilliant, brilliant NGO. And, you know, they work with all diverse communities, the young people, and they teach them how to channel their anger. They teach them that if you're approached by drug gangs and people who are trying to manipulate you into doing something that you instinctively know is wrong, to harm other people, how to have conversations and how to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, the kids are not trained. And here is where the irony is. You know, when a child is born, doctors and parents inoculate them against whatever virus is present at that time, you know, smallpox, polio. But we don't inoculate them against radicalization and radical messages. And sometimes they're innocent. They don't even know that these messages are, you know, tarnishing their mind and warping their way of thinking. So it's a very subtle program. And it's been going on for so long that, you know, we've come very late into the picture, but it's never too late to save our children, because they are the future of tomorrow, and we need to find ways. And when we look at the example of Europe, it's very frightening because...
Oh, they're a disaster.
There are men, women, children who have been sucked into this. You look at what the Nigerian armed group Boko Haram did. When they had kidnapped those young girls, they trained them to become terrorists and suicide bombers, and one girl blew herself up with a baby strapped to her back.
Wow.
And you would think, you know, why? How would a young person do this? But this is what
that's some hardcore programming. I mean,
it is hardcore.
Jim Jones would be proud. I mean, yeah. That's,
we do need to have a counter narrative, a counter program,
sure.
Because no one is born a terrorist. No one is born a radical. Someone radicalizes.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize or don't think of is, when, you know, they're coming from a culture and a society that is so dysfunctional, and it's all they've ever known, they come over here and it's so foreign to them, they don't fit in. They don't know how to act. They don't know what to do with it.
And I guess they are kind of separate.
Yeah, they just kind of naturally go back to what they know. And then you get somebody, you know, talking sweet stuff in their ear about how they're going to make a change. And, I mean, I can understand how they could swing the wrong way. pretty easily.
Well, yes. I mean, I have two sons who have grown up here, and I know it could have been very easy to radicalize them. It's the conversation around the dining room table. It's what parents do at home. It's what they talk about. And kids pick up on these nuances. So are we teaching our kids loyalty to the land in which they live? Are we telling them how blessed they are to live in a country where they have freedom of choice, where they have, liberty, equality? No, in many cases, that's not the kind of messaging that they've been getting.
And that's where it starts.
That change in narrative is extremely important because, yes, those kids who come from traumatized countries have seen nothing but war. And instead of understanding that they have an opportunity to live in peace, that syndrome in them, towards violence and war, gets incited by the extremists who prey on them.
Right.
Who are looking for just such young targets, people who are at odds with their life, who are economically frustrated. And this is what we see in many immigrant communities. So it's the process of integration, settlement, and, assimilation is a very important factor where the government has to play a very important role in this.
How much of a factor is it that the parents don't know, a lot of times, and this has nothing to do with being immigrants, actually, a lot of times parents aren't very well versed in technology. And so they don't even know how to monitor their kids' online activity. The kids have, they have Facebook pages that the parents can't find and all that kind of stuff.
A lot of them don't speak the language, and the kids do.
Yeah, you have that.
Yes, there is a huge generation gap among the parents and the children. And, the parents have somehow just let go. Now, with immigrant parents, you also see this syndrome where they think that if they're going to send their child to a religious institution, somehow they've absolved themselves of the responsibility of teaching them. And, I know this as a Muslim parent. We sent our kids also to Sunday school, but the difference was we went with them just to make sure that we knew what they were being taught. And when my son was going to university, sometimes, the radical kinds of students would come to him. And our message was very clear to him that, whatever you want to learn about the faith, we will teach you at home. No one else has the right to teach you that. So you just shrug that off and talk to us. So that communication between parents and children is important, but how much of that is happening, in this world of...
And you don't have to be an immigrant to have that kind of gap with kids. We see that all the time.
That's a great point.
We have to take a really quick break, but let's pick that up on the other side because that's a big deal, and if you guys can intervene in any of that, that would probably make a huge difference. Our guest today is Raheel Rasa. She is with the Clarion Project. She's an advisory board member, and we're talking about radicalization. I was thinking, Raheel, back a long time ago in another life, I taught English as a second language. And I noticed we had a wide variety of people, some Asian. I mean, there were people from Sweden all over the place. But the constant was the parents who didn't speak English and didn't know a lot about the culture, they deferred to school and what their kids told them, really, about how things work here. We had a huge problem starting in our community with Laotian, actually, and the Laotian gangs were becoming a big deal because the kids would tell the parents, "Oh, American kids, they stay out till 11 o'clock, like on school nights. They get to do, you know, this, that, and the other crazy stuff that American kids didn't get to do." But they were the translators for the
parents.
Parents
didn't know the difference, though.
Parents had no clue because the kids were the translators. They spoke English. The parents didn't. So the kids just really walked the parents right through the whole thing and got away with, I mean, things that we...
Well, my kids tried that too, but
how'd that work out?
When my kids were growing up, we monitored what they saw on the internet. We didn't give them cell phones till they were adults. We knew who their friends were. We knew who their friends' parents were. And so, you know, you have to have a very active part in your children's life. Now we are looking at a time when children and parents communicate through a click of a button. You know, so and it's all about sound bites. How much communication is there? So everyone has to be part of this movement. This is the important thing that I tell all my audiences and people that I meet, that depending on just the teachers or counselors, you know, all religious teachers, to somehow shape your children's life is not enough.
Well, you said something earlier.
Told responsibility.
Yeah, you mentioned something earlier that kind of struck a chord, and that was you told your kids if you want to learn about our religion, you get that from us and not from somebody else. That's a really good point. And I just wonder how many parents actually do that in that culture.
But see, regardless of your culture, the same thing, we were talking about it on the break, same thing goes with sexuality. You know, a lot of parents have deferred to the school system for that.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, we all know that message is all over the map, most of it going the wrong direction.
Right.
Well, we see what's happening to our kids. Look at the world around us. I mean, it's a dangerous world.
Oh, boy.
I'm glad that my kids have grown up, and I'm concerned about, you know, my grandchildren. And I do the same with them. We talk about everything. So, you know, we alert them about the dangers of, you know, stranger danger, and we alert them about bullying. We talk to them. But how many parents talk to their kids about radicalization? And this is a no-no because, the regressive left political correctness has sort of made people immune to the idea that they can talk about the dangers of radicalization. But if we understand that this is a global movement, this is a global jihad, so to speak, and these extremists are just waiting around the corner for kids who are, again, have questions or are at loose ends and have no support systems, and they grab them. Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way of, intervening, again, before they get to them. And that can only be done through educational programs. That can only be done, through some sort of programming that is sponsored by the government. And, of course, our activism on the ground, and by everyone being involved, which means civil society, parents, Muslims, non-Muslims, everyone, because when there is a problem of radicalization in America, it is not a Muslim problem. It's an American problem, and it needs an American solution.
But I think what you said about government involvement wouldn't the kids be more leery of a government program rather than getting their guidance from community leaders and parents?
But the government needs to help the community leaders.
Back it up, sure.
Right.
Yes, they should back it up because, you know, these are programs which need funding. They need support. They need a green light to go ahead.
Yeah, you need
We can't get into the school systems without, the education department approving it. So, it's a circle, and everyone has to hold hands and somehow be involved. Now, when I was in Austin and I met law enforcement, and when I met the chief of police, he said, "I want you to come and speak to, you know, my officers on the ground so they can be aware of what the issue is." So we have a mandate where we say we have to expose the problem, educate the masses, and then empower for change from within. the communities themselves have to be the frontline people, the parents who are going to talk to their children, the teachers, the educators. But they need the material, they need the tools on how to have this conversation without being called Islamophobes or racist or bigots.
Right, because that's the big shutdown.
Easiest way to shut up any conversation.
Yeah. Tell me this, what about these, what about the people who just didn't see it coming, they came here, they were so busy trying to figure out how to live their life and survive and all that, and maybe they came here with a child who was a teenager already, and this kid goes back to visit the relatives, because we hear these stories all the time after some bombing or whatever, and they went back to visit relatives, and I mean, my guess is the family thought they were going back to visit relatives. And instead, they were going back
for this big training program.
What's the likelihood that you can help after that process has already kicked in? And the parents are going, hey, I think there's something going on with my kid.
Yes. So this question has come up that can you de-radicalize a young person? And we know people who actually have been radicals and then have, come out of it with the help of counseling or support. And then they become the speakers. So actually, they are the best people.
That's the way to do it.
The youth. There is an organization called the Quilliam Foundation, and they do this because the person who founded it was a young British radical, and then he has completely turned over, and now he speaks to youth and tells them how easy it was to get radicalized as a Western-born young person.
And what is it called?
It's called Quilliam. Quilliam.
Interesting.
The Foundation.
All right.
It's run by a guy called Majid Nawaz. Brilliant organization. Probably the first in the UK to start these circles of learning and start these programs. The UK has had more problems, but they have been far ahead of us in addressing the problems and actually creating narratives that to help the situation or creating material. And the government is involved in this counterterrorism program. So the problem is that, terminology like counterterrorism and, anti-radicalization just gets people's backs up. But we have to look at the larger picture. The safety and security of our children is extremely important. And the safety and security of the land also is extremely important. And if we understand that we are doing this work for the betterment of our future generations, then, people should buy into it. But of course, it has to be created for each community individually according to their needs. And this is why I use the example of the Somali community. To me, it is one of the only communities that has actually reached out and said, yes, we have a problem, and could we get help? It's rare to see this happen, in closed communities.
Sure.
So we when they say this, then we want to find ways to help them. And the work has to be done from within activists of their own community. So they can speak to their own people in a language that they can understand. But they need the tools and the support on how to address this issue.
Where are you finding the most success? Because I'm in my head, I'm picturing little kids, the younger, the better. But that's not necessarily true. They don't always get it when they're little.
Yes, it's a difficult conversation. It has to be presented, in a very, depending on the age group. So what we are going to do with this documentary is that there's going to be a child-friendly version, which, can be shown in school so that it's an easier language for them to understand. And that's why it's important for Muslims like me to be in the forefront so that I can speak about it without being pushed back. And so, as a mother and a grandmother, I can address it with feeling because, this is something that could have happened to my children, and it can happen to anyone's child. And so the more women that are involved in this programming, the better it is, because the mothers are the teachers, the nurturers. And so it's important for them also to understand what is at risk here. And, we have a wish list. We're going to see how this pans out. But the hope is that we can slowly build up communities, support activists, that, we can train them to go out and do this work.
Well, that's kind of awesome. I've also added it's QuilliamInternational.com is their
Quilliam Foundation.
Quilliam Foundation, not Quilliam International?
No, Quilliam Foundation. Maybe it's called Quilliam International now. I mean,
yeah,
I could be wrong because they are spreading internationally, yes.
Yeah, because it says the world's first counter-extremism organization?
Yes, absolutely, they are.
Okay, good. Because there were a couple other Quilliam things, but they were kind of unrelated.
No. This is them.
There's quite a bit of information online, so I just wanted to let people know I posted that on the site if you'd like to read more about it. Pretty interesting.
Yes, definitely. That's
very cool.
That's something.
All right, we'll take a really quick break. We'll come right back and finish up to the top of the hour with you. Anything we've left out, which is probably everything. So many things we don't know. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I was at the immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in. Let me in, immigration man. Can I cross the line and pray I can stay another day? Let me in, immigration man. I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway. And your smile is a thin disguise.
For all those terrorist recruiters out there.
Yeah. Nice try.
We're wise to your gig now.
I like your choice of music. Very appropriate.
Yeah, maybe you can, you know, work in some oldies but goodies to your training thing.
Yes, I'm sure music would be a great help. In fact, I often think that if the extremists were exposed to some good classical music, perhaps it might calm their nerves and they would put down their arms. But of course, they think that music is a sin. So. Yes, most all of it, absolutely. They think that it diverts. And anything that's good is a sin for them. It's, killing, of course, is not a sin for them. But
Yeah, how confusing. It's kind of like now where we have, like, smart cars that are stupid and we have, you know, smart meters that are stupid. And good music is all bad. Wow. That does explain a lot about them, though.
All music is bad, yeah, so you can imagine their mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother was a classical cellist, and so obviously I didn't grow up in a home that was going to be radical friendly, I suppose. So do you find any places in the country that are more,
susceptible?
Yeah, like hotbeds for this stuff? I mean, are you guys targeting certain places as opposed to, you know?
Well, anywhere that there are large immigrant communities, because, this is a relatively... a new issue. It wasn't there. I mean, there were different kinds of extremism and radicalization 50 years ago, but what we are talking now about is the war that the extremists have declared on the West. So the education component of this is extremely important. It's important for ordinary citizens to know that there are influences of the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, of Wahhabism, Khomeiniism, and so it's important to get the whole picture and understand how insidious these messages are. And the irony of the situation is that the extremists who are living right in our land, use our very freedoms against us.
Sure.
They know just how far to go before they are above the law. They just stay under the line. So they're very, very clever. And I think that one of the big mistakes Western governments have made is to think that somehow these people are, barbaric, illiterate people living in a cave in Tora Bora. They couldn't be far wrong. They have spent billions of dollars on technology. They know how we tick. They know how we think. They know what buttons to press. They know exactly how to use the system, and they do it to the best of their subversive agendas. So we need to be a little clever. There's a difference in between being compassionate and kind, and we want to be that. We want to be humane. But I always give the analogy that I would love to invite people into my home and take care of their needs. But if they want to disrupt my furniture, I would be very careful about that. So, you know, we have to look at those people for whom loyalty to the land is not a priority, who want to destroy us from the inside. And once we are aware of that, then, you know, a counter-narrative, a way of dealing with it is extremely important because, as I said, it's a war of ideas. It's not a war of weapons. So no amount of weapons can deal with this situation. It's like the head of a monster. It'll keep popping up. So we have to go to the root. Where is the messaging coming from? Who is radicalizing our kids? And while we create the programs of prevention, we also have to, you know, find where the evil is coming from.
Right. Are you finding the influence of these folks gaining steam, or are we kind of heading it off a little bit more now that we're getting smarter about it?
Are we?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I mean, you'd have to be kind of stupid not to notice that there's a pattern. But, I mean, our media regularly buries the facts and tries to make it look like, oh, this has nothing to do with an ideology. This is just one person who, you know.
Lone wolf.
So, of course. So, you know, that definitely gives them encouragement. You know, when there is a terrorist attack, you have everybody coming out, you know, they're not in the talking head saying it's a lone wolf. There's no such, in my understanding,
no
such thing as a lone wolf.
No.
Well, even a lone wolf belongs to a group somewhere.
Somewhere, and someone has radicalized them.
Yep.
This is what I mean. So, you know, they have the support, they have the weapons, they have the finances. So it's coming from somewhere. And that brings me to my second recommendation that I made to the U.S. Congress, which is to track the foreign money that is coming from those countries that promote terrorism. It's coming into our universities, into our educational institutions, into our religious institutions. And that needs to be tracked because, you know, you track the money and you take care of half the problem. So there is funding for these people, and you need to know where it's coming from and put a stop to it.
Well, we have organizations that are operating in the U.S. that I think are pretty, I mean, Muslim Brotherhood, CARE, some of these guys
yes.
that are obviously bad guys promoting the wrong stuff, and yet they have been able to kind of silence the critics because...
Well, they're operating within the boundaries
of the free speech
legality.
And all that.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely. So this is what I meant. They're extremely clever. They promote the victim ideology.
Right.
And that victim ideology then, you know, creates other problems. So and that awareness is there. But, you know, we as activists can only expose the problem. The policymakers are the ones who have to take charge. We would like the Muslim Brotherhood to be declared a terrorist organization like other Muslim countries have done. I mean, the United Arab Emirates has declared CARE a terrorist organization. How cool is that? It's a Muslim country that has done that.
Right.
Yet in America, people are reticent to speak out and say anything because, oh, my God, they'll be called bigots. And this is how successful the regressive left has been. So when you ask me if the problem is worse, it has gone underground, and it's worse because people are not allowed to speak out.
Right.
And, you know, we say we are the land of the free, but are we? Our universities now have a 2x4 square where you can go and have your free speech. But
or you can cower with puppies and crayons in the safe space.
Yes. So where is the free speech? I mean, I came to the West 30 years ago to embrace these values, and I see them corroding, and, you know that your forefathers fought for all of this. So when we don't have a freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and at every step someone is monitoring your words and there's thought police, then these issues fester because this is exactly what subversive groups look for.
Right.
To promote their own agenda. There's a rise in, you know, white supremacist ideology. There's a rise in fundamentalism in all religions. And you see this happening as a sort of a, you know, pushback or reaction to what is happening in the world. So
when they
need to be clever.
When you made a great point there. When you came here, it was the land of the free, and now we are silencing, you know, with all this politically correct speech, How does that kind of make you feel, or how does that make the communities feel when they know that there's really nothing they can do about speaking out and not being labeled?
Well, that's kind of, I mean, my understanding is that's kind of what your project is all about, how to talk about it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Thread the needle to talk about it without being labeled
and
haters.
That is definitely one part of it, is to be able to talk about it, because unless we talk about it, we can't talk about the solutions. So it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen this happen in front of my eyes. I mean, so, you know, you look at it and you think, what is the world coming to? But we are citizens. We have a right to vote. We choose our elected officials. So, you know, I believe that in a democracy, we should be able to, you know, promote that right to free speech and fight back against this thought police and, you know, fight back against these restrictions. But, you know, people are ambivalent. They want to just go to work 9 to 5 and play golf and have dinner and parties. They don't want to acknowledge that there is a problem. And I understand that because, you know, it makes your life miserable.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and an awareness of the problem puts a great deal of responsibility.
Right, but the alternative is much worse. I mean, if you don't address it and we don't get a handle on it, what's coming at us?
It's obviously not going away.
Is going to be a lot worse.
I know we only have like a minute and some, but what kind of pushback are you getting from the Muslim community in general? I mean, if you can generalize it.
No, you can generalize largely.
I'm assuming it's pretty big.
It is, but we are also very positive. I'm an eternal optimist, and I always have hope. And the reform movement does an extraordinary amount of work, and people can, you know, look at our mandate. We are growing by the day. People are supporting us, both Muslims and non-Muslims. And those people who can think for themselves, you know, understand that this is an issue that must be talked about. There are many scholars and even imams who are coming on board to say that we must talk about this. If this is an internal problem in the Muslim world, we as Muslims have a moral and ethical responsibility to address it in a respectful way. Now, what happens is that, of course, there's always the other extreme, you know, where it's offensive and hateful, and that doesn't help the cause, because this is exactly what the extremists want. They look at it and say, aha, see, they hate us, and you know, now this is why we have to kill them.
Sure.
Yeah.
People must realize that there are ways of dealing with this.
Right. Well, keep up the good work. I mean, it's a blessing to have somebody out there fighting a good fight, so... Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, and as you have more programs and things, keep us posted, and we'll have you on so you can talk about them.
We will. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks very much. Our guest has been Raheel Raza. We're going to be shifting gears, talking about the FISA process next hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. What are you chewing over there?
My cud.
Bill ran out of the room, came back chewing. I don't know what's going on out there. Oh, my gosh. So, my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find all sorts of information about us. You can. We have emails and phone numbers and lots of archives going back to 2010 at wethepeopleradio.us. And so if you want to complain or give suggestions or, you know, all that kind of stuff, the information's all on there for you. And sponsor this hour. Are you done chewing? I don't want you to be talking with your mouth full, because people will know.
I come prepared for business always. Yeah, our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota dealer. And they are at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, up there next to Phil's Propeller.
And I know the phone number because they say it all the time, but they always say 226-9226.
Yeah.
It's really 226-9226.
That's right. And, if you're looking for a Kubota or John Deere tractor, go up there and give them a call. They're running service specials right now. So if you have a mower or a tractor, it needs to get kind of freshened up before the springtime hits, go in there and see them. They can get you get you going and get you back in the field and going to work.
People are probably thinking, well, with all this rain and then weird snow we drove through last night, probably not going to need a mower right away.
No. No,
yeah.
Yeah.
I heard it's supposed to get hot, though. It'll be like hot next week.
It'll be overnight. We go from rain to summer.
From winter to summer.
That's right. Yeah. So go see Team Power at 3119 Twinview Boulevard.
Just north of Reading.
Just north of Reading and Shasta Lake.
And
there we have it.
There you go. All right. So moving on, we are chatting with Bruce Moran this hour. He's a national security advisor with Security Solutions Technologies. And Bruce is a regular contributor. How about that? That's a good word for it. We've had Bruce on bunches of times. We talk about all sorts of things. He did send us a document I tried to print online, but I had to just post it as a PDF. Sorry about that. About FISA warrants, the ever-looming topic of FISA, mm-hmm. things that we never wanted to know, really. We were, like, happy that the government was doing whatever. I'm using the word happy in air quotes. They were off doing their own thing, and now we have to all learn about it so that we can follow along with what's happening.
Right.
Otherwise, it makes no sense.
I'd kind of like to talk about the John Bolton appointment too before we.
Well, it's not up to you; it's up to Bruce.
I know. We'll squeeze it in though, right, Bruce?
Yes, sir. Still an appointment. Strong personality, works well with General Mattis and General Kelly. As you know, General Kelly is the Chief of Staff and General Mattis is Department of Defense. So you need people in place now to handle North Korea, Syria, which is still in question with ISIS. We routed, President Trump made sure ISIS was routed out of Iraq. ISIS still has remnants down on the shores of Libya, but interspersed through Libya. And they're doing slave trade there. Everything's just up in arms. So AFRICOM has its hands full. AFRICOM is the arm of the military, and it handles all of Africa. So that's the short term for AFRICOM.
Well, John Bolton's been around a long time. I mean, he's got a pretty good handle on what's going on over there, doesn't he?
Yes, sir. It goes all the way back to Bush. We were in Iraq. You know, he has a lot of, experience.
Right.
Through the years of handling, and he's on various committees now. You know, he's at AEI. We're all kind of intersecting, at the Heritage Foundation, a very strong group of economic freedom that helps establish a protocol with the Wall Street Journal. That's Ed Boehner, Ed Meese, Jim Carafano, Becky Dunlap. What a crew they have there, and John Bolton's very well acquainted with them. They've been working together over the years. He's familiar with Grover Norquist. It's ATR. Grover's the head of, as you know, the group that heads up the tax reform that we had going here. The president's initiative was taken off the ground, had a large impact on the economy. So John is well familiar with all these different issues and concerns, like now with China. With the intellectual property rights, that's why I mentioned Grover Norquist's name. It dovetails into everybody in Washington that can add and contribute to help out with the national security program that John's going to bring to the table and help make it more fluid, make it a stronger policy. The previous administrations had weaker policy in Iraq. As you know, ISIS came in and ran right through Mosul. Established a headquarters there and there in Raqqa, which is Syria. And then we look at North Korea. Nobody in the last 25, 30 years, as President Trump has really pointed out, had a firm foundation on handling North Korea. Now they're coming to the table with us. And John Bolton's from the same cut of the cloth. He understands that. He's worked with it. He's able to handle it and then work with everybody in the State Department. As you know, we have a new head of the State Department, Pompey. We have a new head of national security, which is John Bolton. So he's going to be able to get a better handle on what has gone down and what the president wants. It's going to be a president's initiative. You work at the request of the president. He's bringing in a whole new group of people here to bring forth this policy and his programs to be instituted through the entire executive branch. That's all the departments and agencies from top to bottom. As you know, there's been pushback. So John Bolton will help formulate the policy, the programs, along with General Mattis and Pompey and Kelly, to bring a very strong, formative program on national security forward. And I can say more, but I think that's enough to cover that particular topic.
Yeah.
And he's not particularly shy either, so no, it isn't like outspoken. He's going to take, you know, a long time to get that done.
Oh, that'll be very interesting because they're all very strong personalities. And the president, of course, you know, he has his idea about foreign policy that needs to change. And they've gone about making substantive changes, especially when you're coming to the table with North Korea. It's never been done.
Right.
And I think that's a remarkable, you know, part of the mission of the National Security Council and the president that has to be really recognized and understood as being a pinnacle part of something that's never been done before. And then they'll be addressing Iran. And the deal that went down with Iran, you had all kinds of different intersecting, I would say, nefarious actors, you know, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and different forms of terrorist, which we're getting into almost immediately here, counterterrorism, which you have to have a warrant for from the FISA Commission. So these are the kind of things that when you start to take a look at the broader base of national security, you're going to firm it up with John Bolton in there, and he's going to get a lot of help, you know, from people around him. He'll be bringing in a different team probably, clear out some of the people that were there before. You still have people that were there from the previous administration.
Right.
So I'm thinking, you know, he might bring in some other people to help out, round out.
Yeah, because that's been
a larger perspective on a newer dynamic program in a new dimension for national security.
Cut back on some of the undermining.
Yeah, because that's been a huge problem, and it's getting turned around a little bit. But I agree. I think there's still too much of the old administration in there, kind of having their way. And I think it's going to take somebody like John Bolton to get in there and root this stuff out and get everything back on the right track.
The media, of course, is demonizing him because, you know, he's a crazy person, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right.
Which is kind of funny.
We'll see.
But it always
tells
you he's a good guy if they're demonizing him, hasn't even started yet. Got to take a really quick break, have a little celebration of capitalism here. And we will be back with our guest, Bruce Moran. We're going to start chatting about FISA. If you would like to do a little reading ahead of time, you can find it online.
Put a few more in the ground.
Send them all to their maker and he'll settle on down.
You can bet he'll settle down. Cause justice isn't one thing you should always find. You gotta settle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
And we'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, saying, whiskey for my men, beer for my horses. Whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Pretty decent lead-in for the FISA process. All right, Mr. Moran, what do you have? Where would you like to start?
As you can see, I've taken on a more serious tone. For
I this. Know. What's up with that?
Oh, yeah. Well,
nice.
It has to do with the covert operations. That's what a FISA warrant's for. And I hand it to all our people in the military and intelligence community. It's my special honor to them when they conduct covert operations anywhere around the world and domestically, they're put at risk. They are put at risk. Their families are put at risk, and this is what this is all about. It's about them, the methods, and the sources. And the American people need to understand it. This is very, very serious work. It's supposed to be founded on espionage work and covert operations, counterterrorism. And if we moved it to a political realm, well, things are moved to a political realm. But if it's weaponized, then it has to be taken under very serious advisement to have a special counsel, which Trey Gowdy had talked about. Charles Grassley, Senator Grassley, and
you mean using the foreign intelligence?
That's why I'm talking seriously about it, because there's a lot of flags that come up, and if we're putting people at risk, and it comes in so many different forms and fashions today. And if you're not only looking at it, you know, they're saying, no, cybersecurity. It's not only cybersecurity; it's people on the ground. People doing things, and if they get their covers blown, Christopher Steele, who had put together the dossier in a very short fashion, his cover was blown about 7 years ago. He had to get out of Europe. This is how serious this is. Or you get killed, or you get compromised, and your family can get strong-armed.
Right.
And then they're held hostage. So these are things, and Christopher Steele knows this for a fact, and he's worried about it now, because now he's part of a U.S. investigation, and he might be, you know, brought up before the court, and it's 5 years for perjury. He can go to, you know, jail himself. So that's what I'm saying. It's very serious in that context.
Why would he do that? I mean, it seems kind of silly that he put himself in that position.
You know, he had a different position. He thought the Trump administration was not, or President Trump himself, you know, he didn't want him to be president. So if he decided that, and he decided to create a dossier to, you know, which would be used as a foundation of evidence for a FISA court, then, you know, that was his prerogative. You know, you can't tell people what to do and how to do it. He might have had other motives, but that's for him to answer for himself as an individual. You know, I can't judge him that way. I can see what was done and look at the effects of how it had on the FISA court and the warrant itself, and that's what we're talking about. Why was that kind of evidence presented to a FISA court? Here we have a special agent. They're not saying it that way. They're saying MI6. He's a special agent. He does covert operations, and he put together a dossier on a president-elect. Why are we having a special agent from a foreign country investigate a president-elect? That's a question you ask.
Right.
And if it's, you know, if this is a dossier and it's information that was fallacious and didn't have any bearing, and they got a warrant for it, we have a serious problem here. And that's what Trey Gowdy was saying, Charles Grassley, and Lindsey Graham. We've got to find out what happened, to what extent, and who was involved, how the information was gathered. And they call it harvesting. When you harvest information, you don't always find out all the way down. Think of a pyramid like Giza, and it goes all the way down. A lot of information coming up isn't traceable, because it's for, you know, plausible deniability purposes. So this is something that has to be answered in a court and with the general counsel investigating different people who are part of this FISA warrant itself.
You've been around this.
It's the process, the FISA warrant process.
Right. You've been around this a long time. What's your thoughts? I mean, what do you think's going to come of this? I mean, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously,
but counsel.
Yeah, it's obviously.
I mean, a chief counsel to investigate and find out what actually happened.
Right.
I mean, you have other players I wrote in this. You know, you have the judges. You know, there you had to go through several judges in a FISA court. It's usually not culpable upon the judges. It's mostly the DOJ, the Department of Justice, and the FBI that present the evidence. But we don't know, and how is that going to be reviewed? How do you review a FISA court judge? Maybe, as I put later in the report that I gave to you, the paper, that the Supreme Court may have to do a more of a oversight of the FISA court and the judges and what they do. Because technology changes, espionage techniques change, people in, you know, covert operations are changing all the time, how they're doing things, where they're going, what the laws are that prohibit them from doing certain things, and how they can do certain things, and what's giving them the probability of being successful, you know, given the FISA warrant. All that has to be taken under consideration under national security. Now, people aren't talking about the FISA warrant as a national security vehicle. It is the highest top secret warrant you can get.
Right.
And that's what I'm talking about everybody that's fulfilling their obligations to the United States and the intelligence community and law enforcement. I don't want them at risk.
Sure.
I don't want them to be, their covers to be blown.
Well, do you think
I don't
that
want them to feel that people in government are politicizing and weaponizing the government secret warrant?
Do you think do you think the judges were misled?
It appears to be so.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much evident that it has to be brought before a grand jury and let them make a decision on, you know, the course of action to take. It's a rule of law that has to be followed here.
What's the penalty?
Jail.
Mm-hmm.
It's a national security problem.
Right, right. And you know, it gets back to what everybody is saying. You know, you can't have
Steele, if he lied, and you know that's 5 years.
But he's
not over in England with a family. You know, and kids. And if he has to go, he has to go, and he has to, he may have to testify.
Will he be? Can he be extradited?
We'll have to see. I don't know. I mean, that's in the workings of the court itself.
Right.
How they to, you know, prosecute if there is a, or test, have them testify. This is all the legal side of the matter that the court takes up with,
right.
With the new chief counsel, you know, that will be there.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be similar to Mueller, but I hope, you know, as Lindsey Graham was saying and Charles Grassley was saying, it's somebody outside of Washington so you don't have it tainted and the American people can feel more comfortable with somebody who is
right.
A prosecutor.
Well, hopefully not somebody who supervised a bunch of bad guys in the past. Well, it's interesting to me that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act, was first put in 1978. So mm-hmm. it's been operating for a long time. I mean, I'm old. I was in high school then. Bill's probably out of high school. He's older than I am. But,
well, I was in law school back then.
I was in law school.
Did you think about it when you're going to the junior prom?
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, we never even heard about this at all until just recently. So it's either operated well or quietly. Yeah, or, I mean, was it being run properly? Is that why we never heard of it? It's always a dangerous assumption with government.
Brings it into question now of how to have oversight. Now, the Supreme Court has a responsibility for the judges, but, you know, and the executive branch and how they execute a FISA warrant. And it's a national security matter. It's counterterrorism, it's spying. It has a lot of larger implications to protect every individual citizen in the United States.
Well, isn't it kind of set up to, you know, you have to. It was set up to assume that people would be honest when coming forth with information and presenting it to a judge, especially one of our government agencies.
Well, it's the intelligence community that utilizes it.
Yeah,
so,
well now yeah. It looks like we have to kind of change it a little bit to protect us from these
some of them
agencies
are rat
that are weaponizing this information.
That's right, and weaponizing the warrant in the process of getting
right.
And politicizing it. So
and the judges
political and weaponizing together, that's pretty bad.
Well, and the judges wouldn't necessarily know, right? Would the judges know that the evidence was bad? They actually would just make the decision with what they're given.
Ask them the question, you know.
Yeah.
Usually,
tricky.
The judges go by what evidence is presented to them, they make a decision on it.
Right.
I say usually, you know, and that's the normal.
Well, that's what they should do.
Customary process. And they know the laws that have to be interpreted to issue a FISA warrant. But if the judges themselves were part of it, it's generally not going to be the case. But if they happen to be the case, then you're only going to find it out through having a, you know, special counsel ask the questions and bring the judges up, if they have to bring the judges up. I don't know this. That's what I'm saying. It's usually not the judges, but if a judge is compromised or been politicized in his beliefs and issued a warrant that way, then the judge got to go, too.
Right.
Who's the judge who was like the cocktail party judge, and then he recused himself from the process? Wasn't he the FISA guy?
Yeah, that was Contreras, and he also had a relationship with
Strzok,
an FBI
right?
agent. You know,
Yeah, the idiot texter.
No, well, you can't say it's good or bad. You have to know what it was, to what extent it was, who was married, who wasn't married. Could it have been compromised for national security reasons? Remember when that happened to Petraeus?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay, so we can take that
General
example.
Petraeus?
If that existed there, then there's a problem there. If it didn't exist, then Lisa, you know, Page and the Couturiers just had a relationship, you know. And that's, Washington's a small group of people, and they all know each other, and, you know, if they had a relationship, that's their business, you know. If it went outside the scope of that, it could have caused national security problems, you know, like I'm talking about. And then that's in a different, I don't know. And I can't make an assessment of that, but that is something, you know, you couldn't bring to the table and it should be asked. And that should be totally clear. If it's just a normal, you know, sincere relationship and there is no problems in national security that people can be compromised, then they're fine. If it went beyond the scope,
right,
and, you know, like they had a problem with Petraeus, then that's a problem.
Yeah, were they really having dinner, or was it the dinner party with the shill guests to make it look like they were having the dinner party so they could actually talk about stuff? And that all looks
a really good question.
It just looks bad.
I don't know. Since I come from an investigative background, I can see all these things as probabilities. You see what I mean? But how do you weigh them? Is it true? Is it false? You know, is it fact? Is it fiction? You know, that's what we're looking at. And when you can't make mistakes here, because these are people's lives. But it looked like it was loosey-goosey when they're putting the dossier together and they didn't care about the people's lives they impacted, like Michael Flynn, you know, and you know, Page, and different people. So if it was politically weaponized and they did it in such a manner and it didn't impact the court or a court judge, but most likely it would be the Department of Justice and the FBI at that level, you know, and those who signed on to the warrant. As you saw, we have the information on there for people to look at it. You know, as Director Comey, you know, Deputy Director McCabe, and these are things that have to be closely looked at, that they followed suits, that they were straightforward, honest, and there wasn't any agenda.
Well, McCabe already burned up on that category. Let's talk about him when we come back.
Good old
Andy McCabe.
Clear enough. I'm trying to keep it simple. But there's a lot of information that goes along with this that we can talk about, but I don't want to make it too complex. And
all right,
sound.
You be the straight man. We'll cast all the aspersions when we return.
<All right>.
You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Yeah, we all know you got plenty of those. That's for sure.
Yeah, we sure do. You stay off the phone when we're out.
Hot there, girl.
Oh.
Just keep
how
going.
Hot? Hot. There you go. I was like, what do you mean? All right, your mic's hot. I thought we were just messing around. Okay, so back to Andy McCabe, speaking of people who are just messing around.
Yeah, he's not a very happy camper today, I don't think.
He's a liar.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Well, we had several things that happened with, he's our deputy in charge. He's the second in command of the FBI. And what we saw just recently, that the Horowitz, who is the inspector general, had he's for the Justice Department. I better qualify that. He had an internal review, and he found probable cause for forwarding the information that he reviewed to the FBI. And the FBI took a look at it, and they're called the Office of Personal, Office of Professional Responsibility. It's like your internal investigation staff at a police
department. Right, internal affairs.
And, internal affairs. So they investigated it, and they said, you can't do that. These are allegations for misconduct. He said, no, this was misconduct.
Yeah.
And they told him, you better, just go away.
And he knew that.
Isn't he planning on fighting it? Didn't he claim that that was all just politically motivated?
Yeah, but he leaked the information to the Wall Street Journal
regarding
the ongoing FBI, corruption investigation with the Clinton Foundation.
Yep.
You just don't do that.
No.
And that's the problem that Christopher Steele had. He leaked the information to Yahoo, which is used part of the dossier, for getting the warrant. In other words, they used the dossier in Yahoo information gathering as a source, but it was the same source. They're building a case that was the same person to build the case. You see how fallacious that is?
Yeah, and it wasn't verified.
Yeah,
it wasn't substantiated.
Well, let's talk about that part. Now you had to verify it. So I'm laughing because it's so serious. It's pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're looking at here is a understanding who are the sources. Did the FBI check the sources in Russia?
Apparently not.
Any of that was done. They relied on Christopher Steele's former allegiance with the FBI. It's probably the CIA, too, with Brennan or Petraeus. When he was a full-fledged MI6 special agent. If he did things before that, it comes under a different category because it's agencies working with agencies and it's non-disclosed. But once it reaches a FISA warrant area, then it has to be full disclosure to the judges. If there wasn't full disclosure to the judges and you can't verify the sources, and then you have a real problem. And I think that's the case here, and it's pretty evident. And that's why Trey Gowdy, Charles Grassley, and Lindsey Graham are saying, this is not normal. This is unusual for finding a warrant. And they know, Trey Gowdy was a prosecutor, he said, this is crazy as crazy gets.
Well, they indicate to the judge that that source had been confirmed and checked out? I mean, or did they just kind of gloss that part over?
I have no idea. That's why they want a special counsel.
Yeah.
It seems if it's politicized and weaponized, then they didn't really do the proper background checks. Here's what's supposed to be done. You're supposed to check the source, then have it counter-checked, then cross-checked.
Mm-hmm.
If those three processes weren't done for a FISA warrant, that's a big problem.
Yeah,
and that's what everybody's saying.
It's not valid.
It's not valid. That's right. So think of that. It has to be checked, so you have to check them. Then say he handed it off to McCabe or two other agents or somebody in the CIA to cross-check it, and then they in turn hand it off to somebody overseas to counter-check the cross-check of the check, then you pretty much have something that can be substantiated as evidence for the FISA court for the warrant.
Right.
So I think I was pretty straightforward with that.
Yeah, yeah. And they've said straight away, since this whole thing started, that it doesn't look like any of that was really done.
That's what we're all saying. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
I don't want to get political at all in this. If it was politicized and weaponized, it's as terrible can be. Because, like I said earlier when we started this, we have people in the field doing covert operations across the board. Well, it's in the foreign services. It's in the CIA. It's everywhere. It's on our borders. It's with the MI6. It's with the DEA. DEA's all over the world, trying to stop the drug trafficking. As you know, the drug trafficking in the United States is somewhere between $250 billion and $750 billion. That's a lot of influence peddling just by them being in the United States.
God, no kidding.
With that amount of money.
Right. Well, so the problem
why
is
so serious because if you're doing counterterrorism work and espionage work and all these people are out there, they can get killed.
Right.
Or the families can be compromised or the kids can be kidnapped.
And if you've got if you've got somebody at the top leaking information, you have to act on that. Otherwise, you're just sending a message downstream that that kind of activity is okay for the field agent.
If you don't like the way things are going, you just flip it off to the.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. You said send a field downstream, but if it's from the top and it's compromised, you don't know what's going on. And you're out there, and they're not going to say anything because they have plausible deniability
right.
if something happens to you. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's worse than worse can be.
Yeah, that's
so. Who compromised you? To what extent you've been compromised, and was your family compromised too?
Right.
In order to get a hold of you, there's a this goes on, and it's untenable to me that we should be even talking about this at this extent.
Has this ever happened before?
Pardon?
Has this really ever happened before? Did we just not, those of us who weren't really paying attention to this stuff, you know?
No, not during the presidential election.
But
remember that Perkins and Cole was the arm for this law firm that sponsored the DNC and Hillary Clinton to give the money to Christopher Steele. See what I mean? That's a big difference.
And they were attorneys for Fusion GPS, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they were the go-between. They represented the DNC and Hillary Clinton that gave Christopher Steele the money, and they probably had some dealings, of course, with Fusion GPS, because that's how they maybe got him the money.
Mm-hmm.
They could have did it a different way. I don't know, but, that's a logical conclusion you're drawing, but they may have done it that way, or they may have not. I don't know what the actual transaction was. See what I mean?
Right.
You have to see how the money was given to Christopher Steele. Was it done through Fusion, GPS or not? Or was it just done to him directly in London or, through his other firms? He has his own firms too,
mm-hmm.
Orbis and that. So,
how much are these guys sweating out potential, a special counsel and investigation and all that stuff? It would seem like they should be kind of worried.
I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as we look at, Andrew McCabe testified that no surveillance warrant would have been sought from FISA without the Steele dossier information. So,
oops.
If he goes before a, special counsel, it looks like he's going to have some major problems.
Yeah, major.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to go,
Yeah.
I don't want to be hyperbolic with the,
Yeah, we have enough of that out there.
Yeah.
That part's being handled.
You see, I'm keeping an even keel here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Do you think as a result?
What the Wall Street Journal was talking about.
The dumpster term.
We knew what happened 7 years ago to Christopher Steele. He was outed himself when he was a special agent in the field when he's working in France. So he had to get out of his own, secret agent detail and go back to London. So whatever they did, they did. Then subsequent to that time, he became a independent contractor, investigator, and recruited him for his special agent skills as being a Russian specialist himself. And that's where all this comes into play.
Right.
So the Wall Street Journal article even talks about it in the sense that how could he put together such important information in a short period of time and give it to the Justice Department and the FBI for them to confirm? And it even talks about it in how I think about it. How could it have eluded the CIA, FBI, MI6, and every other Western intelligence agency that they couldn't come to some conclusion about it themselves?
Mm-hmm.
That's far beyond...
Yeah.
Scope of
what
we're talking about, and that's why a special counsel needs to be. Jeff Sessions has to take the steps necessary to make a special counsel available just for the FISA warrant here, and this is huge in a sense that this is everything that national security is predicated on for covert operations, And like I said, all our friends out there in the intelligence community and law enforcement are doing all this covert operations work. I'm just really concerned about you and your families that this has to be done in a proper and fitting manner. And that's what Trey Gowdy's talking about and Lindsey Graham's talking about, Charles Grassley. This can never, ever be weaponized politically, and it appears to be so.
So we obviously have to make some changes and have more oversight.
Yeah, when we come back, I want to let's talk about that. Do you think this will instigate any changes in the process? But we'll take a break and then we'll do that, yeah.
You can find the document we keep referring to at wethepeopleradio.us. It's at the bottom of the page. Yeah, that's what Andrew McCabe and those guys thought.
Mm-hmm.
You can read your mind.
Yeah.
All right, Bill had a burning question that...
Well, Bruce, I think with the as far as the FISA goes...
I'm here with Mike of Estate Grant.
Oh, hello, Mike. Excuse me, Mike. Excuse me, Mike. I was talking.
Hold on. I think the NSA had burst in for...
Yeah.
That happens on my phone a lot.
As far as the FISA goes, the system... it's been in place since the 70s, and I think it works.
I think we established it was since I was a junior in high school.
You were a junior in high school, since you were a young child.
Remember when she went to her junior prom.
That's right. Now it just seems like lately, every time there's a violation or somebody runs astray of the law, we run out and want to change the laws and so it doesn't happen again. Do you see that happening within this case, or... do you think we're just going to prosecute and leave the system alone? Because I think the system works if you have honest people within the system. And if
as you saw, I put the Brennan Center report on FISA,
yeah.
The changes that need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the FISA court problem is FISA. It's pretty obvious that there are some inherent problems, with the Fourth Amendment and, and how it's going to be addressed. And that's how they issued the warrant. It wasn't for, Michael Flynn at all. It was for, Christopher Page and stuff. But
right.
Carter Page.
Excuse me, Carter Page. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
There's Lisa Page, who was the FBI
Who is
Carter Page. Thank you.
Sleeping with what's his name. And this is like one of those soap operas.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
It will be before it's all done.
Yeah, it has that tinge to it, which, they'll cover it... and if an item on the news media, then they'll draw that in there. But, if that does come into play, it's a national security problem where people have been compromised, then it should be brought forward. But like I'm saying, if it was a normal relationship and these people, were attracted to each other, that's the way it was. Washington's a small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
People meet at,
sure.
different places, and that's okay in my book, but like we saw with General Petraeus, and that went beyond the scope, and he was head of the CIA, so you have to call that into question as he could have been compromised. So.
Right.
Well, the very last item on here said one of the recommendations was, as the U.S. Supreme Court has jurisdiction over all federal courts, what role can the Supreme Court play to ensure U.S. Constitution's been adhered to or not violated, and ensure that the FISA judges... and the executive branch have acted in accord with the Constitution. So One of the things, little blurbs here, was robust peer review every 2 years.
Yeah, that's what I put in there myself.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that's a good note.
Counterchecks and cross-checks by the Supreme Court on the FISA court to make sure, because technology is changing all the time.
Yep.
Right.
The espionage rules, and, you know, they were talking about waterboarding, you know, and, you know,
big fan.
Appointing people and, you know, having, you know, how we do black ops. And, you know, it was okay one time and okay it's not, and then it worked, and but they don't want to say it worked. And, you know, I don't want to get into that discussion about, you know, how that comes into play, but we want to look at the FISA warrant itself. And it does have inherent problems if you don't keep it under review. That's all I'm saying. And robust peer review by the Supreme Court.
Well, besides that, if people can do things in secret and they know they're never going to be checked,
that's
just stupid.
Yeah.
That doesn't work for your kids. It doesn't. I mean, nowhere in our lives does it work like that. We'll just take everybody's word for it that they're driving the speed limit.
Well, in the past,
we're not going to have highway patrol anymore. We don't need them.
There's never been consequence. I mean, they keep, you know, bouncing this around, and nobody ever gets called on the carpet, although McCabe now has been kind of rolled on
the
carpet.
Well, if you look at the, if you look at the Brennan report,
too late.
It was 2015 with Snowden, it did come up, you know, and, you know, that had a, you know, it threw up a couple red flags, you know, about independent contractor disclosing information. Is he guilty of treason? You know, mm-hmm. Same thing with the FISA court. Is there some culpability here which moved over into trying to, you know, influence a government election? And, you know, how does that come into play? Who's involved? You know, they were talking about Cheryl Mills and CIA Director John Brennan. So, you know, how does that play with what they did with Special Agent MI6 Christopher Steele? You need to ask those questions. And how did the warrants, who signed off on the warrants themselves? So those are all really important facets to which needs to be addressed by the Supreme Court, which has that robust peer review, and then by the Justice Department, which needs to review itself, and then you have the FBI as the Internal Affairs, the investigative unit, to address that too. So you have these checks, but it didn't appear nobody was doing any of that to ensure the integrity of the FISA court. That's what I'm saying. I think that's pretty clear what I just said.
It's kind of interesting that it's run this long without kind of going off the rails. It's actually a pretty long time. I mean, I haven't been in high school for quite some time.
Well, it starts at the top, you know. If you got somebody that respects the system and uses it the way it's supposed to be used, you don't have a problem. But obviously this time, I think there was an attempt to influence an election, and it started right at the top.
It's pretty interesting, the idea that Donald Trump, you know, being president, made this many people freak out that bad that they're willing to lose, you know, $1 million pension and, you know, all these things. If this was that... I don't know. This was that hysterical for them that they, I don't know if they liked Hillary that much or they just disliked him, disliked him more. What do you think the difference was on this one? We've had elections, you know, every 4 years.
Well,
we're drawing him into the politics. Can you hear him thinking?
Yeah,
I can hear his wheels turning. He's like, I don't want to answer that.
Yeah, I don't want to do it.
Come on, just do it.
I don't
want
to go there.
It'll feel good.
You're pushing.
Just say what you think. You'll like it.
Let it go.
The politics part of it, because I try to deal on pure national security and not play favorites on either side, I think the FISA warrant process has been violated. It's a national security grave concern.
Right.
And people have to be brought on the table for it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because
to go to jail.
Yeah, that's something you just can't compromise.
That's the bottom line, but... you have to see how this all played out. Now you had other people that were involved, like we were talking about those two FBI agents earlier. You know, you had mentioned them that were having a relationship between themselves, and then their text messages were brought forward, you know, and, you know, they were talking about how they didn't want Trump elected.
Right.
Like that. So, you know, you have...
Yeah, their issues and motivation were pretty clear. I mean, we don't have to... We don't have to make up motives for them.
No.
Well, you think what's
the things was they don't want Hillary Clinton charged? Okay.
Oh yeah, that's true. There was that.
They don't want Donald Trump to win.
Yeah, there was definitely a double standard there.
Yeah. So that was Storch and Page. That's why I say there's two pages. You know, Carter and Lisa.
Right.
I get all my pages mixed up because I got like.
Gotta make sure you're on the right page.
Information here.
Well, tell me this: how likely do you think it is that we're doing special counsel on this? Just from what you've seen or heard,
I think they should do it.
Yeah,
I mean it's the integrity of the FISA warrant itself and the process and how you obtain it. That's where we go. If it had problems like we were looking at the Brennan report here back in 15, you know, with the how to look at a FISA warrant and is a person guilty of treason or not, I thought myself that Snowden should have went through the system, and I would look at it as more as treasonous to go the other way. And then he went over, you know, it stuff like that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And his dad went to help him out and that. So, you know, it's problematic because he's an independent contractor too. You know, he wasn't. Now, see, there's an independent contractor, and we have hundreds of thousands of them that have access to this kind of information, and then he disclosed things which was actually true, you know?
Right.
But how you do it, you see what I mean?
Right, it does matter.
That's what they're saying here, that the FISA process, according to what Snowden did, has to be clarified. What you do with whistleblowers, a lot of them are cast aside and
right.
shut up, you know? And you're seeing that, and that happened with the one case that been in the news quite a bit too. That was with the CFIUS process and a fellow who had done all the work on the yellow cake with the uranium,
right.
Uranium One they call it. So there's a whole slew of issues here, but this one in particular, the FISA warrant problem, has to be addressed because this is the pinnacle.
It's a biggie.
It's the Bruce, pinnacle have, of what you need to do to protect your
We have killed an hour.
And go to a judge in a secret court to get it done. I'm
trying to kill the hour. We have,
thank you, Bruce.
We have to stick a fork in it. It's time to go home and try out Bill's barbecue.
Okay, are we done for
We are. We are. You're free, you're free
okay.
to move
yeah,
about
we
the cabin.
Talk another hour probably. But
oh, we definitely could.
We'll
We're
do it again.
Have you back, Bruce.
Thanks a million. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.